we have one very particular specialization, but the specialization we have is like the core use case for hundreds of thousands of businesses on the planet.
Welcome to Dev Discuss, the show where we cover the burning topics that impact all our lives as developers. I'm Ben Halpern, a co-founder of Forum, and today we are talking about Ruby and Ruby on Rails with Richard Schneeman, principal engineer at Salesforce and Heroku Ruby language owner, and Penelope Phippen, staff software engineer at Stripe and director at Ruby Central. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
So you've both been on some of our podcasts in the past. Penelope, you were on Dev Discuss when it first launched, season one, episode one. And Richard, you were on Dev News not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But just as a refresher for the audience, Penelope, can you start by giving us a bit about your developer background and what you do now?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Penelope Phippen. I use she or they pronouns. I, for a long time in the Ruby community, was the maintainer of RSpec, the well-loved, sometimes hated testing framework by Ruby developers. I, as you mentioned, am a director at Ruby Central, where I work on organizing RubyConf and RailsConf, and was one of the program directors of RailsConf this year. So if you attended, you got to see my face a lot at the beginning and ends of each day. And I also maintain Ruby Format, a Ruby auto formatter. Professionally, I work at Stripe, where similarly, I work on Ruby systems. And in particular, I'm currently working on a very large migration of Stripe's monolithic API.
And Richard, how about yourself?
My name's Richard. I've worked at Heroku for the last 10 years. Heroku/Salesforce/Heroku/Salesforce. Right now, I maintain the Ruby build pack, which if you've ever done Git push Heroku master, it does like bundle install and all that stuff like flies through the screen. That's like me furiously typing at a keyboard, actually, is how that works. Not true. It happens through a process called the build packs. And so I maintain the one for Ruby, as well as our docs and all that jazz. I maintained Sprockets for a while. I think I've like not necessarily... I partially maintain Puma. Like I helped Rails 5 get Puma in as a default web server. Yeah, I'm in top 50 contributors to Rails, but it's been, I don't know, probably a couple of years since I've had a commit there. And yeah, most recently I'm working on trying to get the a gem for showing syntax errors called dead end. I'm trying to get that into Ruby. Right now I am working on a book for open source. It's called How to Open Source. I don't have pre-orders open yet, but I do have a service that helps people get started in open source called Code Triage. If you go to codetriage.com, you can sign up and then you'll get an email when the book comes out, or my blog as well. I also have an email list there.
So how do you two sort of feel about Ruby and the ecosystem today, and like what's generally on your mind, like as you come in, like in the research and things like that?
Sure. I guess like a thing I generally always say when I'm asked questions like this form of Ruby and particularly Rails is like, it remains the fastest way to go from zero to a functional application that can actually do something. And that, like, I have yet to see another language, another framework where you can move with the speed and efficiency that Rails gives you to get something out the door that is like a really powerful, functional, well-built, production-ready application. The ecosystem has only got better for that over the past several years, with Rails 6 doing like lots of work to make it easier to develop on the front end. And like, I would say if you just look at the sort of history from like Rails 3 to where we are today, like everything's gotten better, right? And I don't think anyone could really say like, it is harder for me to ship an application with Rails today than it was 3 years ago. And that, like, I mean, frankly, Richard is extremely well placed to talk about this, having, you know, basically built Heroku by hand for some of these things to like enable the delivery of these applications to production. But like, the thing I so frequently like to remind people is Rails may no longer be the hottest technology in the world, but if you want to go real fast, it's a really good choice.
I completely agree. Can I just copy the whole answer? Copy paste? Rails really shines, and Ruby in general also shines in like organizationally. Like, a lot of shops, especially when you're getting started, like you don't know the shape of the product that it's going to be in. And like Penelope has been doing a lot of Rust. Like I've recently been writing some Rust, and it's like, it's almost like the spiritual opposite of Ruby. It's like, how safe can we possibly be?
I mean, it's the amount of typing and the amount of typing, right? You have both like more characters that you have to input, and also you have way more safety, right? It's actually very funny. Like in my side project I have at the moment, I actually have a Rails app at the core of it that's stitching all of these like components in Rust and Python together. Because like, I was like, I need a work queue. Which work queuing system am I going to use? Oh, Sidekick, obviously, right? And like, Sidekick is like a really great example, I think, of something that exists in the Ruby ecosystem that I've never really seen anywhere else, of just like this unbelievably high quality distributed job processing system. And the thing I think that is just generally true about the Rails ecosystem in particular is that basically in any category of like software component you need, somebody has built an incredibly high quality component for you to use, right? Like OmniAuth, there are tools for generating like super well documented APIs, there are tools for, you know, integrating with random cache servers and all kinds of third parties. Like almost nobody delivers like a third party API today without a Ruby gem that comes alongside it, you know, like Twilio, or I mean the company I work for, Stripe, delivers an incredibly high quality Ruby gem.
Oh, that one.
But like, so, you know, like I think observationally, like so many companies have reached success on Rails that now like we have this like powerful vetted production ready path all the way up to like a scale that like most companies will never reach, right? Like Rails is good enough for GitHub to run it at the bleeding edge. Rails is good enough for Shopify to run it at the bleeding edge. You know, Airbnb is on Rails. And, you know, just fundamentally, like, if you want to go from zero to like something that is production ready and then continue to scale it for all time, like Rails is an evident framework that we have seen that be possible in.
Yeah. And you can also see one of the enduring things about the ecosystem is it tends to be extraction focused. Like it tends to be very like Rails is almost like an extraction from, you know, DHH's company. And like it's like, here are proven things we've needed in production. And Ruby is so flexible, it makes making DSLs very easy. And it makes making these like components very easy, and you can try out, and it's like, is this a good idea? Is this not a good idea? And then later turn around and GitHub can say, oh, you know what? We think like sharding is, everybody can use sharding. We're going to extract this, you know, awesome thing that we got and throw it into like upstream. And it's like very in the ethos of Ruby and in Rails, I think.
One thing I think is really interesting, right, is that GitHub like basically rewrote the connection manager in Rails like twice, I think. Eileen and John did a ton of work on that connection manager, not just for the initial extraction from GitHub, but then basically entirely rewrote it once it had become open source. And so like we kind of find that like all of us can benefit from the work these big companies are having to do, because like they eventually get to integrate these like very powerful systems back into the framework.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly resonates with the work we do. So our code base is called Forum, which is what we've called our company, which is the extraction of Dev, which is the website we built. And years ago, I chose Dev because I wanted to get some basic blogging up and running quickly, but with the opportunity to kind of build from there. And I'd been working in Node in my day job at the time. And that choice was sort of an impassioned rejection of Node in my mind, even though I was still doing it, you know, day to day. But like, it was a little bit just like, good choice. And I think for the ease of getting going and the like, hey, like, let's not make this hard at the beginning, it really worked well to help us get to where we are. And then I think on the decision to kind of later then pivot to like, hey, let's work to generalize some of this, make it open source, the fact that it comes from the roots of being like that of extraction, as sort of Richard started talking about, and the choices that that's enabled for us, you know, because like we also share a lot of conceptual ideas with Shopify, and there's a lot of GitHub crossover. It seems like we have a deep partnership with some of these other organizations contributing to the ecosystem that like you can feel like in some of the details and stuff like that. Does that feeling, you know, resonate when you two are, you know, taking part in development?
Well, and one of the things that is coming up for me as you're talking is Like the Ruby ecosystem is also very focused. It's very focused around like Rails. And even when it's like, hey, we're going to go off the beaten path to Sinatra, it's like, if you make an integration that works with Rails, it automatically works with hundreds of thousands of companies. Like, boom.
Yeah. I want to say, right, like, this is like what we do in the Ruby community, right? Like, we have basically decided, like, Ruby is going to be the best language for you to build web applications and web APIs in, right? And, like, that is a very conscious decision we've made. But, like, what that does mean is there are a lot of things that Ruby is, like, not anywhere close to the best language for using, right? So, like, if you need to build a really super high-performance server that's doing loads of crazy I.O., Ruby is not a good fit for you. If you need to do machine learning, Ruby is, like, super not a good fit for you, right? And so, like, I think when we talk about Ruby and the Rails ecosystem, we kind of need to acknowledge, like, we have one very particular specialization, but the specialization we have is, like, the core use case for hundreds of thousands of businesses on the planet, and that, like, we are uniquely well-placed to help you deliver that value quickly. I think a thing I am sort of, like, notionally seeing that I was not seeing maybe 10 years ago is a lot of these shops are now just sort of by forcing function polyglot, right? So, like, for example, at Stripe, we have a very large Ruby stack for our main API, but we also have things that are doing interchange that, like, are a bad use case for Ruby that we have written in Java or Go. The other thing that I think is sort of, like, really useful to understand is that, like, while Ruby may be a great language for core product, it's not great for everything. And, like, the biggest change I've seen in the last decade is people, like, becoming more conscious of, like, choosing to, like, be polyglot as opposed to being, like, let's write everything in Python, or let's write everything in Go, or let's write everything in Java, right? It's more like, we're going to have this Ruby core, and then we're going to call out to, like, one of these other languages where it is better suited to do that job.
Over at Heroku, like, when I first started 10 years ago, it's like, all Rails app all the time. And then it's like, okay, we're going to get Java, and then we're going to get PHP. And, like, I don't think it even occurred to us that it's like, oh, you could have Java and, like, Ruby on the same compute unit.
Right.
Versus nowadays, it's, like, kind of wild if you don't.
Right.
And we're moving to all of these integrations. And, you know, it's like that actually caused us some issue with our magic and magic detection. And it's like, oh, because all, you know, it's like right now, even saying, like, Ruby and saying Rails, yeah, like, all of them now also are node apps too, right? Out of the box.
Right. And I'm shipping Ruby inside Ruby format, which is actually mostly a Rust program. I literally compile the Ruby interpreter into my Rust program. I have my Battlesnake, which is running on Ruby and Rust and Python. And so, like, one big change I've seen is that, like, the Ruby ecosystems tend to be super polyglot these days.
We're talking about the, you know, Rails ecosystem, the fact that it's a extraction from Basecamp, but, you know, up until this year, I think there was a lot of general community alignment, you know, with what was going on at Basecamp, like the way Rails followed DHH's lead. And if our listeners want to, you know, Google just like what Basecamp has been up to in the last year, you know, a lot of people left the company. You can kind of read into it. It's hard to kind of sum up in a sentence, but DHH and Basecamp is definitely, you know, like their approval rating has dropped this year. Can we speak to, you know, like how Rails will evolve or change, or if they have had to gradually anyway, like, can you two kind of speak to what is changing in terms of how decisions are made or how even RailsConf is going to be conducted, if there's any, you know, sense of like, is it a change from like, hey, we're all following DHH's lead? Can we speak to, you know, that element of what's going on?
Yeah, when all of that came out, I was seeing a lot of people like miss each other in communication. I was seeing like the like Rails core come out and putting out like blog posts and being like, hey, this is what we're saying. Then other people are like, wait, like there's a sense of everybody kind of thinks that Rails is governed and is running in a different way, and it's not really super explicit. And like devoid of judgment. That's kind of how it is. And like I talked to some of the Rails core members about like how are decisions made, and talking to them, like very much I see the day-to-day, the face of Rails as being like Raphael. And like if you go on to the issue tracker, like there's a 90% chance that Raphael's face is going to be like just merge something. And then there's also a lot of other involvement from a lot of other contributors. You know, I think the kind of elephant in the room is, yeah, like DHA still holds the trademark. All of the conversation still occurs in the base camp. I would be interested in having some conversations with some of the contributors about moving the invisible work to be visible and making the visible like explicit and writing down some of these things. Like, you know, if there's a disagreement across people, like how is it settled? And like, you know, right now there's not an official formal process. I've not heard any sort of talk. Like those are kind of all the things that are on my mind.
This is definitely like a really interesting situation we find ourselves in. And I think like I really strongly agree with some of the things Richard is saying around like open governance, around having these procedures documented. Like, and I think this has happened to open source projects that have grown up since Rails has grown up as an open source project, right? So like Kubernetes, like Rust, like some of these projects have like very well-designed open source governance structures that I just think there wasn't prior on doing this when Rails came up, right? And so like, I don't know that it's necessarily prima facie surprising that like Rails's governance structure is informal, because like, I don't know that like we as an industry knew how to do formal open source governance when that happened. And so like, I think personally for me, like I would love to see what it would look like for the Rails core team to come up with a direction for Rails to move in a more governed way, maybe not as formal as like requiring people to post RFCs or like really super detailed design docs, but like begin to work out like, how do we do that, right? Because like right now, like for example, you know, Eileen can decide we're pulling database management out of GitHub and just kind of do that because she's a core team member. But like, what if somebody from another large company who isn't contributing core to Rails has a good idea, right? Like there's no formal structure to like start approaching that problem. So I sort of agree on potentially creating one there. In terms of RailsConf, we don't know exactly what we're going to do for RailsConf this year. It's more than 6 months out at this point. And so in terms of what will happen at the conferences, I don't know that Ruby Central has a clear position at this point.
I have seen more activity from DHH, just like a purely observational, like he's been more, you know, more present, more with like the talking about like there's all the changes to the front end stuff and JS bundling and CSS bundling, trying to get rid of Webpack, got rid of Spring, which is like my, finally.
Everyone's, let's face it, everyone is happy about Spring going away, I think.
Yeah, I need to blame. I turned it off on Heroku. That was like one of my first feeling like, you know what? I own this experience. I'm going to make like a game time decision. Like I'm going to disable Spring for all Heroku customers. Like, and then, you know, it's like magically a source of support tickets disappeared overnight for basically no cost.
There's about as much maybe ambiguity as I was have sort of expected when I asked the question.
I think like if anything were to change, it would be like on the members of the Rails core team to sort of like resolve that ambiguity. And I think notably neither Richard or I are members of the Rails core team. And so like I don't know that we can particularly say what will happen in the future, right?
And would the primary maybe commercial stakeholders in this whole thing be Shopify and GitHub as the biggest influences, or is that maybe just presumptive?
I think that's right. I think perhaps Shopify and GitHub are the largest commercial influences in Rails today because they have deliberately staffed teams with people who are committing on a regular basis, not to like Shopify or GitHub's code bases, but to Rails themselves, right? So like a big difference between like GitHub and Shopify and say Airbnb, where Airbnb is also a Rails app, is that like I don't know anyone from Airbnb who's like showing up to the Ruby open source community stuff. Like I don't know anyone who's like in those discussions. I don't know that. I mean, I'm sure they have come to the conferences, but like I don't know them personally, right? And that like my view on this is that like Shopify and GitHub, it's kind of interesting. Like some of this is that they've deliberately hired Rails contributors, but also they've grown them, right? So like we've seen new Rails contributors come up from GitHub and Shopify in that they worked with contributors who were already there, but like have spent significant time working on open source, right? And so like, I don't know that like there is an explicit sort of like commercial relationship there, but rather like they are big Rails apps and they have people who are working actively on the frameworks, right?
Yeah, my take on it is at some point in time, they said, oh, hey, we've basically invested a lot of this. Like they're betting big on Rails and they want a seat at the table, you know, which it's like also good in terms of, hey, they're upstreaming the stuff, they're staffing changes, you know, they're able to do that and move forward. In terms of like contributors, those two just like come up again and again. And I will also say, like, I've seen like GitHub's kind of ebbed and flowed. Like at one point in time, GitHub had forked Rails entirely and was running on a forked version of Rails. And, you know, it was kind of like this, you know, whatever, like this is ours. Like we've gotten all we can get out of these extractions and we need to make it our own.
Yeah.
I saw this also from some other companies also fork Rails. And then they're like, oh, we're going to start adding features. And it's like at some point in time, though, you end up with such a divergent product that you hire, quote unquote, Rails developers. And it's like, oh, they don't know what's going on. It's like, right. Oh, we're frozen in Rails 3.2 or whatever. You have to know this weird query syntax. It's like, I just got graduated from boot camp. I don't know anything else.
I remember very profoundly when I left DigitalOcean at the end of 2018. There were still Rails 3 apps around. And the reason they were around is because of the sheer volume of monkey patches, right? It wasn't so much running a fork as like just stuff was deeply coupled to Rails 3. I mean, 3 to 4 was a painful upgrade anyway because of the params thing. But like, yeah, I mean, these companies did these internal forks and like what they basically discovered is like, we need to reconcile back to open source so that we can hire, right? And I mean, Eileen did an entire huge long talk about the GitHub journey from like custom fork back to running cleanly on Rails master.
Was there a time in Rails 2, 3, 4, and so on where things were like the survival and the popularity of the framework was substantially lower than we're talking about today? Like, we're coming at this from a sense of pride and stability in the ecosystem. When do you two feel like that was most in jeopardy?
Probably the 2.3 to 3 upgrade. I mean, there are some wild stories from back in that day. Like that was around the time the like YAML deserialization vulnerability that allowed anyone to remote code execute against any Rails server on the internet. And, you know, Steve Klabnik was SSHing into people's servers to deploy the patches for them because they didn't know how to do it. Like Steve literally sat in a corner at a RubyConf deploying patches to people's servers for them, right? And then the actual upgrade from 2.3 to 3 was obscenely painful. Going from 3 to 4 wasn't as bad. And also, like, around that same time, we had the Ruby 1.8 to Ruby 1.9 transition, which was, like, amongst other things, they introduced a completely separate Ruby like, most people don't really know this, but Ruby 1.8.7 to Ruby 1.9 was a massive upgrade because we got YARV, right? And YARV, the Ruby interpreter we've used since then, was not super 100% compatible with the previous Ruby version, right? And so like around that time, it was like multiple pieces of instability were crashing against you at the same time, right? Ruby was also a lot smaller then, and I think it was probably like that was probably also when Ruby on Rails was hot, right? That's when everyone was like, oh my god, you like type Rails G some stuff and a whole web app appears in front of you, right? And I mean, you have to remember that like David gives that 15-minute blog demo and that like that sent a shock around the internet. Like that didn't just land in our community, that landed everywhere, right? And we had Brian Cantrell speak at RailsConf this year. Brian is not a Ruby developer, he works at a company that builds hardware, and he spoke about how impressive it was to see that demo at that point in time. He called it one of the great pieces of software storytelling. And that, like, I think at that time Ruby had kind of the hype, but like, if it didn't, I don't know that we could have survived that transition. It was painful, mm-hmm. right? And I remember this feeling of optimism. I remember going to Ruby meetups and just everyone had this like big smile on their face and we all thought it was really, really cool. It's interesting. I don't feel like we're having the same conversations that we were having back then. I feel like we're not talking about like how to design with objects as much. We're not talking about how to do testing as much. At the time, there was this real movement in the Ruby community around this that I think is not there anymore. I think like it's really interesting how much the culture has changed. But like to come back to the original question, I'm sorry, I kind of went on a monologue there. We have had these big periods of instability in the framework, but I would say everything after 4 has just been smooth sailing, right? Like 4 is when Rails really kind of like settled down. 4 to 5 was an easy transition. 5 to 6, 6 to 7, like these are all easy transitions, whereas that never used to be the case.
Yeah, my favorite is Rails 5, you know? That's when I was able to remove a lot of hacks out of the Heroku build pack. And it's just like a lot of the features just integrated natively. And I mean, going back to the governance and stuff, it was a thing I didn't even have to get anybody's permission to do. I was just able to like go in and, you know, kind of talk with my own PRs, talk with my own 2 feet, talk with my, I don't know, this metaphor is strained. But talking about the Rails 2 to Rails 3, it also reminds me of like, oh, hey, MERB. That was when MERB was integrated. And like,
right.
And sometime, like in the whole like Rails controversy, I like in my head, I had a flash. I had this idea. I was like, there's an alternate universe in which MERB won that.
that
contest, that conversation. But it's so weird because like prior to that, Bundler was not a thing. And like when I started working at Gowalla, like I think either they didn't use Bundler or it was like just barely really new, or like it was maybe in the pre 1.0 days. And there would be days at work where I would just like literally spend the entire 8-hour day trying to figure out what the hell. It's like, oh, you're just requiring this gem, what version of it is it? I don't know. I'm going to go ask my like coworkers, like what path should it be on? Like, you know, is there any, like there's no consistency? Like, and so, yeah, it's almost kind of like this lockstep of, in my mind anyway, this lockstep of pain and then like fixing, like pain and then stability. And I think one of the big things to Ruby's credit is it's able to move forward and it's able to not just get like stuck and stagnate whenever it's feeling that pain. Likewise, though, like, seeing as many Rails apps as I do, speaking of like old Rails apps, like we have a ton of like, and there's Rails LTS, there's a ton of people still running on like, you know, old versions of Rails.
Right. But like no one older than 3.
Rails LTS still supports Rails 2. I am probably going to be dropping support for Rails 2. I'm honestly considering dropping support for everything under Rails 5 and moving it to a separate build pack and being like, hey, this is, you're just getting what you've got currently. But
sure.
I mean, I think this like stability and upgrade story, coming from the perspective of I'm semi-responsible for running millions of like apps and like I, you know, see these pains multiplied by, you know, million times a million. I do wish we were a little actually had a, as a value, conscientious upgrades, maybe. Like we've gotten better, but like I still feel like there's room for improvement.
I feel like the upgrade path is way easier now than it used to be. Like, maybe to put this contrastively, right? Like, I know lots of people who had 3 to 4 pain. I know relatively fewer people who had 4.2 to 5 pain. I know almost nobody who had 5 to 6 pain, right? And I mean, your sample size is bigger than mine, for certain. But, like, the amount of pain is clearly going down over time. Like, these upgrades are getting easier. The framework is getting more stable. The changes to these APIs are, like, being done in a more incremental way. Like, if you start a Rails app now, it's going to be way easier for you to move on to 7 to 8 to 9 than it ever was in those early days to move from, say, 3 to 4 to 5.
So as is so often the case, we've let Rails overshadow Ruby, you know, I think a little bit as the conversation has gone on. So Penelope, I want to give you a chance to talk about the most interesting things you feel like you're doing or seeing in Ruby through your work with Ruby Format and Stripe and like Ruby itself, regardless of Rails.
Things that are really interesting to me right now include compilers and JITs. So like
we now have seen a handful of JIT implementations in Ruby, both MJIT and then Shopify's JIT, the name of which completely escapes me right this second.
I think it's YJIT.
YJIT, yeah. And then Stripe has released the Sorbet compiler. And that, like, we are sort of seeing these approaches to making CPU time-bound Ruby faster, which take all sorts of, like, varied approaches. And I think this is really interesting because, like, one of the things that has always bound the Ruby language is how efficient it can be on CPU time and machine density, right? And if you can JIT or compile away that problem, then Ruby becomes a much more compelling language for, like, really, really large distributed systems. The other thing I will say, though, is that, like, whenever we talk about this, I think it's always important to remember that Ruby is an incredibly fast interpreted language. Ruby is as fast or faster than Python in nearly every CPU-bound benchmark without JIT, right? And the reason for that is that, like, just all of the non-JIT or compiler performance work that has gone into the language over the last decade since Matt's announced Ruby 3 would be three times faster. But, like, yeah, I think the compiler and JIT stuff is really interesting right now.
Speaking of it, as a scripting language, like, when you go and talk to Japanese developers and you go and talk to Matt's, they do believe that it is more general purpose. And, like, they would never say, like, okay, we can make it 1,000 times faster, but it'll have a 10-second boot up time, because then you can never use it for scripting. And, like, scripting is a core thing that they want to support.
To that point, right, I mean, in Japan, they have Ruby in cars, they have Ruby in satellites. Like, at the Ruby Kaigi in Fukuoka, the Fukuoka government sponsored the conference. Like, that's equivalent to a state, roughly speaking, in US terms. The local state basically sponsored the conference because, like, they had determined that the Ruby programming language was of such significance to their industry that, like, they wanted to be part of it. And the governor of Fukuoka Prefecture came to give a speech at the conference about the importance of the Ruby programming language to their local economy. And a thing that I sort of found really interesting on that point is that, like, Ruby is used totally differently in Japan. It powers embedded, it powers industrial systems, it powers all sorts of things that, like, we would never think to use it for over here. And that, like, I have no idea why, but I think it's fascinating.
I'm actually very excited by the error highlight gem into Ruby 3.1. It's kind of showing a, hey, we're valuing more the, like, they've always valued developer ergonomics, but they're valuing it more. And it's like, having come from recently just doing a little bit of Rust, seeing a little bit of the ergonomics around errors and exceptions and just more human readable, which also gives me hope and faith with the gem that I'm working on with Dead End. The other thing that's really exciting for me is Raptors. They don't work super well. Like, it's very experimental. Like, they don't work super well with the rest of the Ruby ecosystem. Like, they can cause, like, a seg fault, like, non pretty easy. But just in terms of a, like, being able to unlock and use, like, multiple cores, kind of once it's a little bit more baked, opens up areas for Ruby to be a lot better in, say, than, like, if you, like, yes, Python, you can do, like, NumPy, you can do, like, the matrix stuff, like, which is hyper optimized. But, like, you're still restricted to one global interpreter lock inside of Python. And so I think that is a really kind of exciting area to see explored.
Well, this was a lot of fun. Thank you both for joining us.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you for having me.
This show is produced and mixed by Levi Sharp, editorial oversight by Jess Lee, Peter Frank, and Saranya Barak. Our theme song is by Slowbiz. If you have any questions or comments, email pod@dev.to and make sure to join us for our Dev Discuss Twitter chats every Tuesday at 9 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Or if you want to start your own discussion, write a post on Dev using the hashtag Discuss. Please rate and subscribe to this show on Apple Podcasts.